I'm Greg Johnson.
I'm John Morgan.
I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back together doing a weekly podcast again. And as usual, I want to begin by thanking our donors. We are almost a month into our annual fundraiser, and we have reached the grand total of $18,105.92. So we are 18.10592% of the way towards our goal of $100,000, which is great. And I want to thank you all. M is giving $50 a month. R is giving $200 a month. D is giving $10 a month. M is doing $20 a month. O is doing $20. M is doing $50 a month, F for $5, J for $15, K for $30 a month, C for $10, R for $16, S for $160, F again for $5, J for $100, that's very generous, B for $100, C for $30 a month, which is very generous, J for $50, another J for 100, very kind of you. J for 100 again, different J. An A for 100, M for 10, S for 30, AB, one of our friends in Brazil, actually. I'll give that bit of a shout out there for 100, very kind of you. C for 50, A for 50, AB in Brazil again for $30 a month. Wow. And Peter, that's a very common name. I don't think I'm doxing anybody by using it, for $5. And also KK for $10 a month. So again, we were at $18,105.92.
Oh, thanks, everybody. We all appreciate it.
Well, yeah, I think it's, it's a good opportunity. Not everyone can be out there and put their face out there and put their name out there and be sort of visible in their support for nationalism and criticizing politics of mass immigration and so on, replacement migration. So it's a good opportunity for people to support others who can.
Exactly. And one of the things that happened back in the month of May is we were deplatformed from our payment processor, which deleted all of our monthly subscriptions. People were giving a certain month amount per month. All that was deleted. And we've had to try and get that back from scratch. We are a little more than a third of the way there in terms of getting those people who are giving monthly donations back. And we're a little more than a third of the way there in terms of the amount of money that we were getting every month. So we've lost some thousands of dollars because of this deplatforming that we're trying to make up. Because with Countercurrents, well, a few thousand dollars is not chump change. It's literally the difference between us being able to continue or not. So I want to thank everybody who's helping out. If you haven't yet re-upped with a monthly donation, please do that now. And if you are thinking of supporting us, think about doing it on a monthly basis. Just set it up and forget about it, and we will be thanking you from the bottom of our hearts every month, because you're going to help us plan and make our bills, and it just makes things a lot more stable when we have these monthly donors.
I also think it's important for morale, because the reason why they try to deplatform us on every level, on YouTube, on Twitter, on payment processors, platforms like that, is because they try to demoralize us. So if we can bounce back every time that happens, that helps to strengthen morale among our own people, and that really makes us stronger and shows them that it doesn't work, you know.
Yeah, the big news for deplatforming in June was, of course, our YouTube channel, which had about 8,500 subscribers and more than 300 videos on it, was completely deleted, just gone. I went to the channel and it said this channel does not exist.
They didn't even give you a notification or anything.
No. They were striking videos off the channel, and then suddenly it was gone. Now, about a week after that, I started getting strikes on my Facebook account. And every time I got a strike, I would immediately appeal it. Because Facebook is a vast organization and has 20,000 people employed to censor its contents.
Many of whom are going insane, as we found out in that article.
Yeah, there's a great article about this. some of these people they have very poor pay, and they spend a lot of time looking at horrible things like videos of delinquents setting iguanas on fire and things like that. But there are 20,000 people who are engaged in censoring content. And so somebody was going after me, but then I would request a review and some other person would look at it and think, what's wrong with a picture of a book called The White Nationalist Manifesto? They were actually taking down simply pictures of my book that I had shared with people. So I had 12 strikes and 10 of them were reversed. And then they shut the entire account down. It just disappeared. It disappeared on the 1st of July. So that's that. I am no longer so invested in Facebook. And I think what we might do is simply take the Facebook recommendation icon off the front page.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, it's kind of dated now anyway.
Yeah. For one thing, the number of Facebook shares that an article gets is seldom correlated very closely with the number of people who read it.
Yes.
So sometimes there will be articles that get 90 or 100 shares and the article gets read 500 times. Mm-hmm. Whereas other articles have 2 or 3 shares and they'll be read thousands of times. So I think as Facebook becomes increasingly censorious, as is YouTube, it just becomes increasingly irrelevant. We don't need those platforms. We have our own platforms. And I think that until something new comes along that's not censorious, I just sort of want to invest more in our own platform, build it, and people will come. One thing I want to do today is reflect a bit on the American character, and especially the character of the American right, because we are recording this on July 4th, Independence Day. And one of the most blackpilling and enraging articles that I've read recently was published at VDare, or at least I read it at VDare. It's by Ann Coulter. It came out on June 26th. It's called Ann Coulter on Kobach, The Swamp in Action. And I just want to read some passages from this because it is truly outrageous. We all know that the Trump administration got off on the wrong foot, that staffing and personnel equals policy. If you have the right personnel, you get the right policies. If you don't have the right personnel, you get bad policies. Trump, it was reported to me by reliable sources, was absolutely bound and determined not to hire cuckservatives and Republican hacks after the shameful behavior of Ted Cruz, the ungracious and shameful behavior of Ted Cruz at the nominating convention, the Republican convention in July of 2016. And there was great hope, and Ann Coulter was very much a part of this great hope, that he would start recruiting people, finding people outside the Republican establishment who actually believed in his populist nationalist vision. And when he was elected, the transition team created this website called greatagain.gov, which was an attempt to bring in people, fresh blood, into the system. Many, many people put in resumes at that organization. I don't know of anybody who got hired through that process. And instead, the process was seized by basically conservative Republicans or just Republican cuckservative types. And there was a data dump, a leak of the backgrounder reports prepared on various potential high officials and cabinet officials for the Trump administration that came out recently. And Coulter is commenting on the background report that was prepared by Republican Party hacks, RNC, Republican National Committee hacks, on Kris Kobach. Now, Kris Kobach is a very, very impressive guy from the state of Kansas. He's one of the most principled and far-sighted opponents of mass immigration. He's a lawyer. He studied at Oxford and Harvard, I believe, or Yale. Has absolutely impeccable establishment credentials, but he's also a man of the people, a nationalist, a populist, and a fighter, a proven fighter. And he was one of our dream people for major positions in the Trump cabinet. Mm-hmm. He could have taken Jeff Sessions' place as Attorney General, for instance. That would have been great. There was talk about him being put in charge of an initiative to suppress voter fraud, which is absolutely crucially important for Trump's reelection. Trump did not get a handle on the border and immigration, and he did not get a handle on voter fraud. It's astonishing. He knew that America's future was threatened by race replacement levels of immigration, and more proximately in the future, the Republican Party's existence was threatened by this. And yet, when he got into office, he did almost nothing. Yeah. He just tweeted and blustered and shuffled people around. And the failure...
Trying to blame the Democrats for not getting the wall, even though the Republicans controlled everything, all the branches of government for 2 years, and somehow they couldn't get it done until just after the Democrats came in. And
then, right.
Then, well, it's their fault that we don't have it.
And beyond that, he didn't even need the Congress. He could have simply ordered these things to be done. Yeah. It's utterly mysterious how this happened. A lot of people just think Trump was a phony and a fake to begin with. I don't think that's true. I think that he sincerely ran on these principles because if he were simply ambitious, he could have basically cloned Jeb Bush's platform,
right,
and still beaten all these people in the primaries because he had more personality, more wealth. You know, he was a celebrity.
But as Ann Coulter points out in the article, I mean, the reason why he caught everyone's attention was because he was the only one willing to talk about immigration.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
All the related issues. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think it's obvious that when he speaks off the cuff, it's obvious that he sympathizes with us on some level, maybe not, you know, 100% on everything, but I think he clearly does. I just think he doesn't know how to make it happen. And he certainly, whether a more capable person could do more, that's debatable. But I think, you know, in his case, too, he just has enormous forces arrayed against him.
Right.
As evidenced by this article, people in his own party.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, let's just read some of this and dig into it. It'll give us more food for thought. Everyone wants the names of the FBI officials who approved the unprecedented law enforcement dragnet against low-level Trump aides in the middle of a presidential campaign. I want the names of the staffers at the Republican National Committee who prepared Trump's backgrounders on potential hires for the new administration. I'm not interested in finding out who leaked them because I assume it was the Russians. When America is no more, future generations are going to want to know who murdered our country. Below is a random selection of the idiotic quotes from the RNC's vetting document on Kris Kobach when President Trump was considering him for Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Instead of Kobach, who could have saved the country, Trump appointed a series of imbeciles who managed to engineer the worst immigration crisis in the nation's history. If this cretinous document had anything to do with Kobach being passed over, then there are specific people whose names we're going to need. Quote, immigration hardliner. The RNC seems to think hardliner means supports current federal law on the books, passed over generations by Republicans and Democrats, negotiating compromises and getting their bills signed into law by a series of presidents in both political parties. Quote, would you ever allow your support of policies that strengthen immigration enforcement to conflict with bipartisan compromise legislation negotiated by a Trump administration? Who wrote this question? John McCain? Jeb? Basically, the litmus test here is he going to compromise with his enemies on crucial issues?
Yeah, and it's quite typical for the left to frame things like that, hardline, use words like hardline or extremist for completely normal middle-of-the-road things
yeah.
that they don't approve.
But the thing is,
this isn't the left. This is the Republican National.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but they fall into the narrative. They fall into the narrative.
But why
of the left? Well, because the left controls the framework. That's the point. I mean,
yeah.
that's why conservatism never can be the solution to our problems, because What we need is, I mean, conservatism competes, or conservatives, or, you know, Republican rightists, if we want to call them rightists, they compete with the left to conform to the standards of the leftist narrative, or the narrative or the framework of values in the modern world. And that's why we can never just play that game. We need a transvaluation of values. We need to reshape the framework of values that guide our society.
Which is what Trump's election could have enabled to happen, but here we see that his own party was undermining that from the very beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Even after Trump won, the RNC proceeded as if nothing had happened and their goal was to pass a new Gang of Eight comprehensive immigration bill. They wanted Kobach to swear fidelity to a policy that had just been soundly rejected by the voters and their own party. Quote, "Given your history of campaigning on immigration politics, do you believe you have the ability to strike the appropriate tone?" Tone! Democrats routinely call Republicans racists, liars, warmongers, homophobes, haters, rapists, etc. But somehow only conservatives are ever accused of having a tone problem. Again, the RNC seems sublimely unaware of the entire 2016 election. Trump called Mexican immigrants rapists and won. The RNC is worried about an erudite Midwesterner's tone. How's this tone? F you, RNC.
I like that Ann Coulter never pulls punches. She just lays into people who she thinks deserves it.
But I think, that's the limitation of Democratic party politics. Basically, what you can expect, or what I expected all along from you know, Trump's election and Trump's election campaign, is that, you know, it would make the left frustrated, would force them to make fools of themselves even more than they do, in usual, and it will bring some of our topics to the fore, mm-hmm. up for debate, open up the debate for our cause, and bring attention to our cause. But when it comes down to, you know, policy making and so on, we can just expect business as usual, as long as we don't control, mass media, as we don't control the framework of the debate, because that's just the nature of populist politics. It will fall back into the mainstream framework.
But always. That's what Anne is saying, though, is that they're out of tune with the mainstream, because the mainstream voted for Trump because mm-hmm. he's speaking about immigration. That's why she says, well, that's, they're pretending like the election didn't happen.
Well, right.
They don't understand why he won.
Right. By mainstream, in this context, I just mean the mainstream media narrative, basically. That's what you can expect them to follow.
So basically, yeah, they're more concerned about what their opponents and what the media are going to say about them than they are about their own electorate.
Well, that's what they always do. I mean, I often quote, Rockwell, George Lincoln Rockwell. He said that he had more respect for a communist than a conservative, because a communist will go to the electric chair for what he believes in. Mm-hmm. A conservative will back down as soon as he'll call racist or whatever. I mean, that's just the will to politics, the will to power in the conservative milquetoast right.
Yeah, and this really goes to the question of the American character.
Yeah.
Quote, "Kobach is credited with helping draft the controversial immigration law allowing Arizona state and local officials to check the immigration status of individuals they stopped." Controversial is what idiots say when they don't have a real complaint. I can't be sure about all of them, but by my account, at least 300 of the 400 members of the current Democratic presidential field support slavery reparations, Medicare for all, free college tuition, eliminating ICE, transgenders in women's bathrooms, abortion at 8.9 months, flinging open our borders and providing free dental care to illegals. But according to the RNC, supporting immigration laws currently on the books is controversial. I note that it wasn't controversial at the Supreme Court, which didn't overturn these laws. But then there's another quote here. Quote, "Much of the law was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2012. She comments, the morons at the RNC aren't even familiar with the landmark Supreme Court ruling they're citing to bash Kobach. The essential feature of Kobach's bill was upheld 8-0 by the Supreme Court. And these people say that it was struck down, mm-hmm. basically. I mean, this is just utterly false.
Yeah.
And but this is the kind of craziness. This is almost like gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what was going on here is obviously this person wanted to derail Kobach. And so they loaded it up with this loaded language, and they even went so far as to lie mm-hmm. about this kind of stuff. It might as well have been dictated by the New York Times.
Right, or the SPLC.
Yeah, exactly. But these are Republicans.
But I mean, that happens not only in America. Sweden Democrats, for example. I mean, populist parties generally, sort of populist, mildly nationalist parties in general, they are always weaker than their electorate. The people who vote for them because they are painted as, you know, evil Nazis, basically, in yeah. the mainstream media. And yeah. that's, people are tired of mass immigration. But all the while, you know, despite the fact that that's why they are given the votes they're given, they always want to conform to their enemies' narratives and standards. Always, mm-hmm. always. And I mean, that's the great weakness. That's why they can't really, you know, we can't expect them to change things.
Right. Quote, Kobach has advocated for use of a technicality within the Patriot Act that would potentially force Mexico to pay for the wall, in quotes, by holding hostage the millions of dollars that Mexican nationals in the U.S. send home to family each year. This reads like it's actually written by Hillary Clinton's speechwriters yeah. or these people at the New York Times. I mean, every bit of this is just jam-packed with tendentious rhetoric. The use of a technicality. Well, what is a technicality? Well, provision of the law, of course.
Yes.
You know, what is a technicality? A technicality is a law that people don't like,
yeah.
right? That would potentially force Mexico to, quote, pay for the wall, as if this is a questionable concept, by holding hostage money that they're sending to their families. We're holding hostage money that they're sending to their babies so they can get new pairs of shoes so they can walk across the border and invade our country, no doubt. She comments, holding hostage? It's known as the Treasury Department's taxing authority. Idea for the RNC's next policy paper. The Trump administration advocates for use of a technicality within the law that would potentially force taxpayers to pay for government services by holding hostage trillions of dollars that Americans spend on their families each year. She writes, the Kobach backgrounder is the equivalent of me writing the vetting documents for the Obama administration. Now, this is great. Quote, controversies is the heading. Kobach faced criticism for speaking at what some called a white nationalist conference, she comments. Holy moly, that's a blockbuster. I've followed Kobach's career for years, and I'm floored that the Harvard, Yale, Oxford graduate is consorting with, quote, white supremacists. Oh, wait, I see. Here's the RNC's evidence. Quote, Kobach was a presenter at a writer's workshop last week for the Social Contract Press, a publishing house that the Southern Poverty Law Center includes on its list of hate groups under the category anti-immigrant. Anyone in media and politics, in casual conversation around the water cooler, certainly anyone at the RNC who cites the SPLC as anything other than America's leading hate group, needs to have his head examined. This is on the order of the NAACP using KKK literature to evaluate job applicants. This is pretty good. Quote, during the campaign, Kobach's opponent tied him to white supremacist groups. Oh, his opponent tied him to something. It's like taking one's ex-wife's testimony seriously. Again, with the white supremacist groups, guess who this time? Guess, FAIR. The Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group concerned with, yes, that would be the principal assignment of department for which Kobach was being considered, immigration. In fact, FAIR is a little namby-pamby on immigration, certainly compared to, for example, the Angel Moms, Bernie Sanders circa 2016, or I don't know, the President of the United States. Who at the RNC wrote this document? I want their names and I want them killed. I just think this is amazing. More likely, the nitwit responsible for this swamp manifesto will be appointed Trump's new DHS secretary, Department of Homeland Security secretary. That's kind of breathtaking, but I mean, what is going on here? We've already sort of said it, but let's sum it up. We have people who are ostensibly on the right, and this is some little worm, you know, some little staffer working at the Republican National Committee, some 20-something staffer probably, who's putting this stuff together, and he doesn't like Kris Kobach because he's opposed to immigration reform. Why is he opposed to immigration reform? Well, basically because the Republican Party's views on this are dictated by the Koch brothers and big business that want open borders and falling wages. That's what's going on. We've got a combination of libertarian economic talking points and dogma, this brain virus that infects the right, plus just pure self-interest, naked yes. greed, people dismantling the American middle class by allowing the third world to flood in. That's what's dictating this. And so this piece of trash, which reads like it could have been written by the New York Times, is fed into the policy process yes. and ends up with one of the best people in America basically stiff-armed over and over, actually, for various positions within the administration. Well, idiots and imbeciles and cucks get these positions, and the country drifts and drifts into the worst border crisis in its history under the most anti-immigration president since the 1920s. How was this possible? It was possible because of staffing decisions that were punted to idiots whose views are, whose conscience is dictated by the New York Times, the Koch brothers, and the open borders lobby, Republican version. And that's just appalling.
This is not so unusual. What we get with mainstream politics is this good cop, bad cop game. It's the same thing in Sweden, for example, where you've had the left criticizing the right for inhumane views on immigration and so on. But every time you have a rightist government, they will increase immigration, you
know? Right.
And they'll play this game in the mass media of calling each other names, and the left will call them inhumane, but still they'll increase immigration all the time. So go figure. I mean, it's people just put too much trust in mainstream politics. Take it more seriously than it deserves.
I wonder how this person who created this document really sleeps at night, how he squares this behavior with thinking that he is an honorable human being. And it really comes down to the rot at the core of the American character. And the rot at the core of the American character really has a lot to do, in my view, with Calvinist Christianity and classical liberalism. Because the Calvinist attitude that is sort of widespread, far, far more widespread than Calvinism itself in America, is just the idea that your justification in the world is whether or not you win or lose in the struggles to basically make money and gain status. You know, Calvin taught that external wealth, worldly wealth and power were signs of divine grace. And basically also that if people weren't doing so well in society, well, these losers, they need to be shaken off, you know, the devil take the hindmost. If somebody loses in society, they're scum. We don't need to worry about them. That really is at the core of the devil take the hindmost kind of predatory capitalism that you have in the United States.
But how do you see that relating to this particular situation? Because you actually have, I mean, the Republicans with Trump hit on a winning strategy.
Yeah.
And here you have their own bigwigs turning their back on it.
Yeah.
I mean, if they went all into it, they'd probably guarantee their success for years to come. Yet here they're sabotaging
the thing
that actually enabled them to win the election.
Yeah, and this is sort of paradoxical because here's the thing. The right in America, the Republicans in America, always salve their consciences for the lies and betrayals that they routinely engage in because they have this bizarre image of themselves as winners who are on the side of winners and who are winners, well, the rich. And Greg Hood actually wrote about this, and he said, you know, the great farce of American politics is that the Democrats pretend that America is ruled by a heartless right-wing oligarchy, and the Republicans pretend that they are that oligarchy.
Yes, that's
true. And neither of it is true. I mean, the country is ruled by a left-wing oligarchy, and the Republicans who pose as the people who are on the side of the winners, you know, look at your iPhone. You know, aren't you grateful for the immigrant who created that iPhone? Bow down and worship capitalism, right? People who created that iPhone, Apple Corporation, they're solidly on the left, right?
So you think that's what's behind this, is that the people who created the original document were thinking that, well, you know, we've got to stick to this oligarchical line, you know, that, I mean, immigration is great for America.
It's good for the economy.
Somehow it's
good for the economy. Yeah, and yet at the same time, they just saw that repudiating this message is the winning strategy. Yet they think that they're winners by sabotaging the strategy, and they're never winners because they're always losing.
Well, I think what it also shows is that they have contempt for their own base.
They have contempt for their own base, definitely. They think that the public needs to have its votes stolen from it or fleeced from it so that they can enjoy power to do something that their donors want instead, the real winners, right? And yet, at the same time, the whole mentality here is a delusion because the right has been slowly losing everything since the 19th century in America.
Yes.
I mean, just Dabney was talking about, you know, how this was in the 19th century that you could predict that the progressive party was always going to win just by the character of its opposition, which is to always lose. He had these people nailed, and yet they think of themselves as winners and on the side of the winners. And then the other thing is that, you know, there's just this bourgeois individualism in America. The kinds of people who do this sort of stuff, they only think about themselves and their careers and their status. They don't think about the good of the country as a whole.
No.
The essence of liberalism is the idea that the common good doesn't exist, or if it does exist, we can't know what it is, or if it does exist and we can know what it is, we still can't do anything to bring it about. You just have to let human selfishness bring it about through some mysterious alchemy that Adam Smith talked about. And so basically what that licenses people to do is just behave as selfish individuals, looking out for their own. This guy is a careerist, right? Yeah. This guy is a careerist, and this guy always knows that upward mobility and legitimacy in America are in the hands of his enemies on the left. He doesn't think, if I follow this general principle, will America go to perdition? Because classical liberal bourgeois types don't think that way, right? Mm-hmm. He's only thinking about his own interests, his own good. And, of course, that means serving the interests of the donor class and conforming to the rhetoric and framing of the left. And that's exactly what we get here. Mm-hmm. We get a document that serves the interests of the donor class and conforms to the framing and rhetoric of the left. Unfortunately, those forces will destroy America. And those are the forces that were rejected by the electorate. But the electorate doesn't matter, ultimately.
Are conservatives in America conserving anything at this point? I can't really think of anything.
They're conserving their own sinecures. They're conserving their jobs as the graceful losers running out the clock on white America as demographic transformation speeds to its ultimate conclusion, at which point the Republican Party and the conservative movement will be completely powerless, and they can be just dispensed with at that point.
But do you think that they really believe their own rhetoric that even if once America becomes majority non-white, it'll be just as productive and just as wealthy and just as powerful as it is today because, you know, everyone is replaceable and, you know, that you just magically become an American by, you know, through the magic dirt theory.
I don't think they really believe that. I don't think they can really believe that. I think they say that. It's kind of like it's just a delusion. It's a delusion that they might believe themselves, and it's a delusion they peddle to their voting base and their donor base. But I don't think any serious person can actually believe that because it's just so dumb.
Well, I don't know what their vision for the future is, if they
have
one.
They don't have one. That's the point. I mean, that's why I just call both of the parties left because that's what they are. I mean, they are left. They represent the fundamental values of the left. So we can call them both leftist. The point is, though, that the quote unquote right must always lose because mentally they have accepted rules of the games. Rules of the game that entail that they always have to seek respectability in the eyes of their opponents.
Right.
While their opponents never seek respectability in, you know, the rights, quote unquote, eyes. And as long as you always need your enemy's approval, then you've lost mentally.
Yeah.
And then you'll continue to lose. And that's why they don't represent anything other than, you know, backing slowly away from power. So they will continue to lose until, you know, they or someone who will replace them as representatives of rightist values, that is us, actually stand for something, stand up for some values and you know, have a bit of more of a mene frego attitude. We don't give a damn about what the enemy thinks of us because we have confidence in our own values and what we stand for.
Yeah, we have to come to a view that these people are evil.
Of course.
And you don't compromise.
They're worse than the left, really.
With evil.
I mean, the leftists at least state what they really believe.
Yeah.
These people are disingenuous. They claim to stand for certain values, but they do absolutely nothing to protect them or advance them.
I mean, the attitude that the right should have is that the left is evil. And really, the what I love about Ann Coulter is she sees how Manichaean this situation is. It's really a question of the survival of America. And when it's an existential question of survival, you cannot compromise between good and evil or life and death, saving the country and not saving the country. To compromise between saving the country and not saving the country is not to save the country.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think on some level that Trump just lacks the moral seriousness to recognize this fact because he's always trying to get the other people on board. He's always trying to come up with compromises and stuff like that.
Well, he's also got to have all sorts of different voices whispering in his ear all the time trying to get him to do any number of things contrary to his own principles.
Right. Yeah, the fact is that the left in America does not think that Trump is legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Trump thinks that the left is legitimate. They are legitimate people to strike deals with.
And the left has even been able to convince, on some level, Trump's base that he's not legitimate. Because that's how they're able to push them around, like this, you know?
Yeah, on some level,
on some level they think
that saving your country from perdition is ungenerous and immoral.
Yeah.
But I think also on some level, a lot of his base just believe in him personally, and they think that whatever he says, that's great. And if he is frustrated on something, they just think, well, that's because his enemies did that to him. They didn't. It wasn't something that he conceded or capitulated on or whatever. Which in one sense is good because they will continue to support him, although. Well, I mean, to take another recent example, of course, this incident in Iran, where apparently an attack was ordered in retaliation for this drone that was shot down, and then he countermanded the order just before the attack was carried out, which is something you would think the left would applaud, but everything that I read on mainstream media websites from the U.S. is about how, this was bad because it made America seem indecisive, and positions that you would think that they would actually like, an action that you would think they would actually like, they think is just because it's Trump, they're going to try to cast it in a bad light. Or the same with him going to North Korea last weekend and stepping across the border into North Korea. If that was Obama, they would be saying that he was the greatest diplomat of the 21st century, if not the last century as well. But because it was Trump, they have to find all these reasons why that was actually a bad thing. And right. I don't think he realizes that himself. I mean, all the accounts that you read, he's constantly watching the media coverage of himself and gets very upset about it when they go against him. So that's also not good.
Yeah. He really needs to look at the Democratic Party and that whole roster of presidential hopefuls as basically like a cult. They're a cult of people who have been driven mad by some kind of moralistic doctrine. I mean, it's a suicide cult, a national suicide cult, as detached from reality as Jonestown. And you cannot allow these people back into power. You cannot compromise with these people. You have to relentlessly hammer away at them, delegitimize them at every turn. And I fear that America is really approaching a time when significant numbers of the 62 plus million Americans who voted for Trump are simply going to say, I don't care what the election says. I'm not going to be ruled by these psychopaths. We're never going to return to civility. And civility was always an illusion anyway. Civility was business as usual, where the left says jump and the right says how high. Where the left is pushing their agenda forward and the right is quietly retreating and putting up token opposition. And that's it. That's that's business as usual. That's civility. And civility is not coming back. I don't see how it's going to come back.
I just wanted to mention as a side note, because he mentioned Jonestown, but something the left in America has tried to suppress that is nonetheless true is that when Jim Jones and his temple were operating, before they left the U.S., when he was based in California, he was on very good terms with bigwigs in the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah.
In his area, they loved him.
Yeah.
And Angela Davis was a big
Jerry Brown, Rosalind Carter.
So there's actually not such a big distance between Jonestown
and the Democratic Party. In the 1970s, and the Democratic Party in 2019 is even more nutty than it was 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that is really a good point, actually. On the 4th of July, we have, of course, the national cult, the civic religion of equality celebrated. Because July 4th is the day of the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence has been turned into some kind of civil religion in America. And of course, we have this claim that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The all men are created equal clause really refers to simply the denial of hereditary monarchy and aristocracy. It doesn't refer to the idea that all people are equal. Certainly not all races are equal. In the very
everyone has identical qualities.
Yeah,
it's obviously a legal distinction.
Yeah,
it's not a description of reality where everyone has the same set of qualities to the same extent.
Yeah, it's a claim of moral equality. But some people say, well, it means that all men have equal rights, including blacks, and that's really not what it meant. Initially, it did not mean that all men have equal rights. It basically meant a denial of the idea that some people are born to rule over others. It's a denial of monarchy and hereditary aristocracy. And the claim that we have inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, I would defend that, sure. I think there are other values that are even more important than liberty and the pursuit of happiness, but those are definitely values.
And the best way to seek happiness in a society is to have a racially homogeneous society.
Yeah, yeah. I would even go so far as to say that all people have rights, in the sense that we simply can't arbitrarily kill people and so forth. That doesn't mean that all people are equally good fits for a functioning society. Mm-hmm. That's an inference that is simply not based on reality. And yet we are constantly lectured to about this document. It's piously intoned every 4th of July. And really, this tendency in America started, I believe, in around the 1820s. And it reached its acme with Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. The tendency of the left in America was, the left-wing revisionist tendency in America was to argue that America needed to be a radically egalitarian society based on the Declaration of Independence, even though it wasn't the law of the land. Mm-hmm. And when Lincoln basically destroyed the old constitutional order and created this new centralized union on the ruins of both the South and the North, when you come right down to it, he did not reach back to the Constitution, because what he was doing really wasn't justified by the Constitution. He said 47 years ago, namely in 1776, they brought forth a new form of government on this continent that dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And so this is the Jacobin leftist political religion of egalitarianism. And the state, the American state, is consecrated to this proposition. That is simply not the case about the Constitution. The Constitution says nothing about all men are created equal. It does prohibit hereditary titles of nobility, which is all that created equal clause meant anyway. But it doesn't treat all people as equal. And it doesn't treat liberty as the only good. It talks about the common good, right? So it's not a liberal, egalitarian doctrine. The Constitution really was just an attempt by people of largely English descent, English language, English culture, and English descent to codify principles of English government that were implicit in the existing unwritten constitution of England without a hereditary monarch, and to get on with the business of living together. And that has been replaced with a Jacobin unitary state dedicated to an ideological proposition of equality. And honestly, you know, if there's one document that I could throw on a bonfire, I swear it would be the Declaration of Independence, or at least erase it from the memory of mankind. And the thing is that the document itself isn't a bad document. It does summarize the reasons for the colonies having broken away from England. And yet it is being constantly misused as if it means something more than it really means.
Well, I mean, when they had the Constitutional Convention a little over a decade later, they didn't just take the Declaration of Independence and incorporate that into it. It was seen for what it was at that time.
It was just a politically superfluous statement of why the colonies had broken away.
Right.
And nothing more. A good piece of rhetoric, and has been used because people don't get these sorts of things to subvert the whole constitutional order as the thin edge of the wedge for basically radically reconstructing America as a egalitarian, liberal, individualist sort of society. It's a terrible thing. But, you know, I looked back at the Declaration the other day because I wanted to see if there are any resources in the Declaration that could be actually used against this liberal, individualist order. And there is one thing at the very end, and I'm actually writing an essay about this, and I hope it'll be out on the 4th of July, but it probably won't because it's becoming a thorny essay to write. But At the very end, the signatories dedicate their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to the cause of independence. Now, when people dedicate their lives and their fortunes to something, they're willing to give up their lives and fortunes for something. But to say that their honor is sacred, it means that they are not going to give up their honor. That's sacred. And the idea that you're willing to give up your life and your fortune, but not your honor, is the complete antithesis of the bourgeois individualist mindset.
Yes. Which is basically what conservatism is today.
Yeah, yeah.
They have everything except honor.
Exactly, exactly. They hold nothing sacred, especially honor. But they're not willing to give up their lives and their fortunes for their country. But they're willing to give up their honor all the time.
Yes.
And do. Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, the bourgeois man basically says that there's nothing more important than a long and comfortable life. So there's nothing that's worth giving up your life and your fortune for. Right? And honor isn't sacred, because the way that you have a long and wealthy life is by compromising on matters of principle and honor that might get in the way of that.
Right.
And so it strikes me as deeply ironic and paradoxical that America could not have been born as a liberal, individualist, democratic society without these aristocratic, anti-bourgeois principles, where people are willing to die or lose their fortunes, but hold their honor as sacred. It never would have gotten off the ground without these aristocratic values. And then it's become a completely shameless, unaristocratic bourgeois society. And the people who claim that they're most fervent guardians of the founding are the ones with the least amount of honor and the least ability, because they have the least character, to preserve anything connected with the founding. This is truly sad. But if we can revive that ethos, that there are things worth dying for, things worth spending your money on or losing your fortune on, but honor is sacred, well, that's the ethos that can overturn the whole thing. Mm-hmm. That's the ethos that can overturn the monster that America has become. The monstrous betrayal that we see at work on the micro level in this disgusting document that Ann Coulter was analyzing.
Yes.
Yeah, honor wouldn't allow you to let someone else invade your country and, you know, assault your children, rape your wife.
Right.
Or moreover, to undermine the principles laid out by the person who's just been selected as your leader, leader of your party.
Presumably, people take oaths. People take oaths of office. People sign oaths and agreements to undertake certain duties. Oaths don't matter anymore, because honor doesn't matter anymore.
Well, there was this interesting piece that actually Colin Cleary brought to my attention recently that Pat Buchanan posted on his website a few days ago, talking about illiberalism and the fact that, you know, the left is so concerned about why Trump is getting cozy with so many dictators, and Vladimir Putin, while he was at the G20 at the same time, they had this controversial meeting with Trump. Was talking about the fact that liberalism has essentially failed. I don't think he meant classical liberalism, not the liberalism of John Stuart Mill and so forth, but this what I usually call neoliberalism, which is this, it's not about being open to various points of view, it's about furthering these very specific ideas and principles that have solidified as the ideology of neoliberalism, which is basically 1968 values plus turbo capitalism.
Right.
That's essentially liberalism today.
Yeah, it's the left-wing oligarchy that Jonathan Bowden talked about.
Yes, and Putin is not the only one talking about this. I mean, it's interesting that he did, although he's talked about this before, but I mean, Viktor Orban in Hungary says many of the same things. but you know, he doesn't attract as much attention being from a country without nuclear weapons.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, so it's interesting. And then Buchanan goes on to point out that, you know, while Trump received a lot of criticism for meeting with these supposed dictators, that the fact is that a lot of the world's most powerful and up-and-coming countries now are in the hands of people who are more or less illiberal, or mm-hmm. illiberal Democrats, as Orban would calls his own ideology, which is that, you know, they still are following the forms of popular democracy, but they're introducing illiberal principles into how their states are run.
Right. There's a quote from Putin that I thought was really, really interesting. He says, "This liberal idea has become obsolete. It has come into conflict with the interests of the overwhelming majority of the population. This liberal idea presupposes that migrants can kill, plunder, and rape with impunity because their rights as migrants have to be protected." Now, what he's really saying there is that liberalism is obsolete because it is in conflict with the common good of society. And that's the basic way of understanding that distinction. Liberalism denies the common good, or denies that politics can pursue the common good, and illiberalism doesn't. Illiberalism believes that you can actually pursue the common good of society, that it's a meaningful thing, and that state power can pursue it. And when you talk about illiberal democracy, what you're really talking about is populism.
Yes.
You're talking about populism that pursues the common good of society, that really pursues the common good, not just, you know, oligarchical interests or whatever, but really looks out for the interests of all people and empowers the state to pursue and secure those interests. And I thought it was a really nice statement. I think it's really impressive that he's saying this. And this is what Orban says. And this is the essence of the whole populist nationalist upsurge throughout the world. We have to give people a new vocabulary for understanding politics that's not liberal.
And I think people have to understand that there's a distinction between two meanings for the word democracy. Mm. One is the system by which we choose who's going to rule our countries, which is a system of democracy. The other is democratic values, quote unquote, which means basically leftist values. And often those two things are in opposition to each other, because the leftists will often claim what sounds paradoxical and is paradoxical, that it's undemocratic to have an election about this or that issue, because they'll not get the results they want.
Of course.
if the people get their say. So people have to understand that democracy can mean two completely different things that are often in opposition to each other.
Yeah,
so the system of democracy, with elections and so on, with people get to say what they want, that's often, you know, that's disregarded as populism. Oh, yeah. We don't want that.
Yeah.
We don't want the people to say. We want democratic values.
But this
I mean, there's a great deal of dishonesty, and we need to point that out.
Oh yeah, definitely.
In the speech on Hungary that I gave at American Renaissance in May, that was one thing that I wanted to point out, was that, you know, Orban uses the term illiberal democracy, but that's kind of a misnomer, because usually the populists are the true liberals. It's the people that we call liberals in our societies today who are being illiberal because they want to impose their values.
They're totalitarian.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I do think that there are several essential issues here. One, we have to give people the vocabulary for understanding that there is a distinction between liberal individualism and the common good. Because as soon as you phrase it that way, most people will say, well, the common good should prevail. That's just natural, normal, morally intelligent views that most people have. And yet, when you don't think in those terms and you just have this sort of default liberalism, well, you have a society that drifts further and further into chaos, right? It's not good for there to be massive confusion about gender roles and sex roles. That's not good for the whole of society. And yet, if you put it in individualist liberal terms, why can't everybody be whatever they want, define themselves as they want? Well, the reason you can't do that is because it's bad for society as a whole to let crazy people set standards.
Yes.
And say, I'm sorry, there are now 56 genders, and you can go to jail if you pick the wrong one when you address me. That's allowing lunatics to run the asylum.
Yeah, you're allowing 0.00001% of the population to set the agenda.
Yeah, and based on whim.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not intelligent. I mean, that's bad for society. It's not good for society to have constant change and demographic replacement and wanton lawlessness. But if you don't think in those terms, you think, well, immigrants have rights, they have due process, we have to admit them all into our country and house them and send them through expensive legal procedures. No, that's madness. And that's what's causing the border crisis in America. We have to change these laws. We can't disintegrate our awareness of the common good into this procedural liberalism that basically is creating a crisis. We can't do that. The other thing that people have to recognize is that there's a difference between valuing liberty and being a liberal. The difference between valuing liberty and being a liberal is the difference between a person who treats liberty as a finite value and a person who makes a cult of it and turns it into an absolute, a non-negotiable absolute. The easiest way to destroy any society is to treat one or two values that in and of themselves aren't so bad as absolutes. Because as soon as you do that, you undermine a whole array of other values that society also depends upon, like trust, cohesion, security, things like that. And that's just not good. So we can value liberty, but we don't have to be liberals. We can value the market. We can be a society with a market that doesn't mean that we're a market society that makes a cult out of capitalism. We can have all these nice things, but we'll lose these nice things if we make a cult out of these nice things, or a cult out of one of these nice things. And that's really the pathology of modern liberalism in a nutshell, whether the left version or the right version. They make a cult out of certain things. And once you make a cult out of one or two select values, you're basically at war with everything else that makes society work. Well, I think we've gone on for about an hour, so we should probably wrap this up.
Yeah, I hope people, well, I guess they'll be listening to this the day after the 4th of July, but I hope they were able to find some kind of a good way of celebrating things, celebrating the occasion without buying into the civic nationalist Kool-Aid.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I think we've had a good discussion, and I hope people enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, we will do this again in a week's time.